Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I've heard that before, I know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Phil Bronstein, editor-at-large of First Newspapers, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Rush Limbaugh. Hang on. Referred to our guest as Hurricane Katrina Vandenhoevel. I actually agree with Rush, partly, that Katrina is, in fact, a force of nature herself. None of the destructive capabilities that I'm aware of, but a great deal of the power. She brings, as you all know, probably a driving passion to her work as the keeper of the flame of The Nation magazine, a flame that I think has gotten brighter of late. We can talk about that, financially and otherwise, and of the progressive perspective. We'll ask her what progressive means exactly, so everyone's clear on the term, because liberal seems to have become both toxic and passé at the same time. I was lucky enough to be on Katrina's team at the Intelligence Squared debate in New York, was it last year?
Two years ago.
Where the proposition we had to defend was good riddance to mainstream media. Needless to say, we each had an interest in this, but Katrina made her case very forcefully and with great elan, as she always does, but with really without a hint or edge of irony or snarky humor, even though she worked for the National Lampoon at one point, or even questionable taste, which I have to say our opponents engaged in throughout.
Throughout.
Thanks to Katrina and a particularly effective close from our third teammate, David Carr, the charming scoundrel of the New York Times and star of his own documentary, we won that night, and we were not shy about celebrating. We were exuberant winners. So I saw another side of Katrina for those who mistakenly assume progressive passion and humor do not mix. But this sense of grace combined with great verve and intensity and style is how Katrina has approached her professional life. And in a world of Kardashians and other circus acts who are sopping up the media space these days, she's not just a breath but a really giant gust of intelligence and classiness. Makes me feel old to say this, but I know her mom a little bit. Equally fascinating woman, herself a great writer, and Katrina comes from a royal Hollywood family. Her grandfather was Jewel Stein, who founded Music Corporation of America, a font from which many key aspects of culture and entertainment these days have issued. Having said that about her mom, I feel I can balance that by saying also that I cannot count on my fingers and toes together all the otherwise haughty intellectuals and even regular people who have confided in me that they have a huge crush on her.
Oh.
Anyway, she's the editor. I'm wandering now, obviously. She's the editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation, which many consider to be a sacred trust or the devil's living room, depending on your point of view. Summa cum laude from Princeton. Mentioned The Lampoon. She's edited a number of books and is here with her first collection. Is it a first collection of your own essays?
It is.
The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. As someone with slightly libertarian leanings, I don't always agree with her personally when it comes to politics. I think they've all wrecked our car and want the keys back. But we're here to find out from Katrina how we're going to save the world with Barack Obama. So let's start there.
First of all, I don't know how you learned I worked at the National Lampoon. Second of all, I'm not leaving the city after all of this introduction. But saving the world. Let me begin with, if I could, after that extraordinary introduction. First of all, how low Rush Limbaugh would be to how desperate they are to go that low, in light of what happened in New Orleans. I wouldn't begin by putting in the same sentence President Obama and saving the world, because my book is very much about movements and the power of people's movements through our history to bring about the fundamental change I believe in. You do need people inside, political leaders, inside, people of passion and conviction and principle. But I finished this collection in the spring of this year before Occupy captured the imagination, but partly because of the DNA of the nation founded by abolitionists committed to ending slavery in 1865, one understands that through this turbulent history it has been movements. And the power of movements, and we were talking earlier, I believe Franklin Roosevelt spoke at the Commonwealth Club, but he too was moved by the movements of his time, labor movements. Frances Perkins was a movement unto herself, so was Eleanor Roosevelt. Lyndon Johnson, the civil rights movement. So I think we begin with that. And this, and then what interests me is this book comes out at a moment when the country again sees the power and possibility of Occupy 99% and how that has shifted, it seems to me, it's still evolving, but has shifted the center of political gravity of our dialogue, and that issues that have been off the radar for so long are back on.
But Roosevelt, you know, one could argue, surfed those movements or even harnessed them to some extent and used them to get legislation passed, to initiate programs. Obama is like still getting on his wetsuit. I mean, if you go back and read the essays that you wrote in 2008, you know, there was a sense of exuberance.
Well,
and I'm just wondering whether, you know, you have a great Haney quote in your book, hope is not optimism, which expects things to turn out well, but the conviction that there's good worth working for.
Right.
And it's seeming like he confused those two things.
But I come back to what I write about in the book, that the expectations were so great, were so high. Go back to 2008. Go back to that election night. Go back to that year when we were fortunate enough to be living almost every week with debates which were not cruel and reality show and drives one crazy. But every week there were debates among the Democratic candidates. And Barack Obama embodied change, and it seems to me he brought into politics a generation, certainly of young people, of minorities, people who had never thought of the electoral system as a vehicle for change. But they also, so many of the young people, saw in him the possibility of change in quick, you know, that it would come quickly. And my sense of our system is that it is so corroded, and this is where we may agree, where you were talking about the cars, the keys to the car, that we need to take back a government that has been rigged against working people, ordinary people, the poor, and people feel it's rigged. We need to understand that it's going to take more than one election cycle to bring about fundamental change in this country, and that it will take wind at the back, not only of a president, but we need to remake a political system in order to bring about change. And I think President Obama is, let's be honest, it's not the political time Roosevelt lived in. The labor movements are not as strong as they were. However, again, I come back to the moment we're in, where today there was a story about the Tea Party losing its mojo. And we're seeing overreach in this country that has led people to this tipping point moment. I really think we're at a tipping point moment where millions of people have said enough. Enough. And that the obscene economic inequality in this country colliding with downward mobility that people feel in their gut. They see it among their families, their friends, people they're used to be working with who they're not working with who are out of jobs. That has led to this moment where there is the possibility of space organizers can move into, movements can move into, and we could see some real change. It's not going to come about just through one leader.
It helps to have a leader who's effective.
Here's my real, and in the book I write a lot about this, and I grapple with this. I don't know, I mean, in traveling with this book, to me, I'm reminded of what candidate Obama said when he said, I'm a Rorschach. People bring to him, even now as president, certainly when he was a candidate, their views, their sense of a country adrift, their anger, the economic pain, or also they're angry in what I am saying often in criticism of President Obama, because they feel he has done what he could in a system where you had a Republican Party that was determined from the get-go to take him down. They didn't want to govern with him. My sense is he wanted to bring a different kind of politics to this country because of the nature of who he is. But you come into Washington, you want to play kumbaya politics. And after about 6 months...
If that were the song they were singing, I'd be happier. That's not the song they're singing.
But you come into Washington, you look in the eyes, God forbid, of, you know, Mitch McConnell, Jim DeMint, and you realize...
They're no pupils, that's the problem.
Yeah, they're not. They're out to take you down. And you need a plan B. And there was no plan B. There wasn't a pivot. And in addition to that, he had these extraordinary skills as a speaker during the campaign. He moved this country. I mean, millions of people. Even as he angered millions and made millions think he was a socialist and other madness. But he hasn't used those skills in a consistent, powerful way to tell a narrative about the challenges, what this country's going through, and where he's taking the country. And as a result, by playing too often on the Republican field, for example, deficit and debts are the great crisis of our time, not joblessness, or saying, we're all compromising. We're all trying to compromise, as he did during the debt ceiling debacle. You make people feel everyone is equally involved in a gridlock that has led to a point where Congress has a lower popularity rating than the banks. I mean, that's a feat that is hard
media,
to believe.
Media isn't doing so well either.
9%. And dropping, even though I would argue there are good people inside the Congress. There's a progressive caucus. They put out a people's budget. Bernie Sanders has exposed the Fed, given out trillions of dollars in addition to the TARP bailout.
And Barney Frank has taken a hike.
That is worth talking about. He's taking a hike because he sees in this Congress Michelle Bachmann's and Michelle Bachmann wannabes, and he's tired of fighting. There's also redistricting, but.
Essentially, you're saying about Obama that the one strength that even his opponents might agree on, which is his rhetorical skill, is not sufficient.
It hasn't been used at this scale it was necessary to use it at in this time of crisis. I mean, America's at a crossroads, I think. I mean, this is a moment comparable to coming out of the Great Depression. This was a moment coming out of the financial crisis when tectonic shifts underway in this country. And maybe, you know, hope is not a policy. And policy, by the way, is kind of a wonky word, but hope needs more than just, you need a story, you need a narrative. In the same way you need, I'm on your side, I'm with you, here's what's going on in this country. And President Obama now, late, is, elections concentrate the mind. But he is speaking more forcefully about what he wants to do, and also, again, smoking out those who are obstructing. This is really wonky. But anyway, I think one of the most exciting things, and I write about this in the book, are the movements of our time. And I, again, closed this book out before Occupy, but I write about Wisconsin. And I think what happened in Wisconsin, and our correspondent John Nichols was there for 57 days, that was about occupying the state house. And I think Occupy has become a kind of, I hate the expression, a brand. It's also become encampments around this country. You know, there are 2,000 or more encampments. But soon it will need to be far more than just a space or a place. It needs to go where the injustice is, needs to go to occupy state houses, occupy banks, occupy Congress, and take the movement energy into those spheres with the ideas that are at the heart of Wisconsin, of Occupy.
Well, I have a question. I mean, it seems that winter's coming. Cities like San Francisco and Oakland and cities around the country are closing down these encampments and chasing people off. And if you drive up 90 miles to Davis, you can get pepper sprayed if you want. It's a critical time also in the sense that it's very hard to maintain people's attention for long periods of time. And I'm wondering why occupy, I mean, shouldn't they really be occupying the Supreme Court?
No, I think that's
because
right.
That's really the place.
No, they need to go.
I'm not advocating.
But they do, and I was talking about that today. With all respect for putting your body on the line, which I think in the beginning has captivated the imagination but it now needs to be less about space and place, the permanent space or place, and more about going to where injustice is, like flying squads of injustice. So occupy the Supreme Court. And there are plans to do so around the second anniversary of the Citizens United decision, which in a crazy decision has given the rights of personhood to corporations, allowed corporations to unleash their treasuries into our already polluted political system. So yes, go there. Go to your local congressperson's office. Go to banks which are charging student loans at the highest rate. Go to those places. And I think we're going to see more of that.
But at the same time,
it needs to be allied. By the way, and occupy Congress means not only, I think, closing out that crazy super committee, but it also means finding movement candidates who will run for electoral office. This is where people get a little antsy because they say, oh, you're co-opting the energy of Occupy Wall Street. But there's a 99% movement, and we need good people in the current constellation and configuration of our system to run.
But that's a problem because, among many other things, what you need is unity of purpose.
Right.
If you're going to get anything done. And, you know, my wife and I were at an event for Gloria Steinem when she was here recently, and they were sort of chanting against the notion, no, they were chanting about the notion that the Occupy movement is male-centric, that you don't see too many women spokespeople, and they had a chant which was 99% doesn't mean 90% men. And however justified that may be, you know, here you already have a movement that's and people in positions of leadership who can inspire other people, sort of rending this garment of unity. And how do you change
I mean, I feel I don't see that. I mean, I think you'll always find there are divisions, and we've written about the fact, though, when I was in Bloomington, Indiana, the Occupy encampment there was led by three women. But you will find places where there are divisions, but I think the unity is around the messages, the core messages of the movement, not you know, by the way, this is supposed to be a leaderless movement, which I think drives a lot of people of a certain generation, including mine, batty, like, where are the leaders? But it is more of a leaderless movement than the New Left was when you did have a lot of guys in power. So I think it's going to find its way. And let's be honest, it's not one place. There is a unity of issues in my mind. If you had to tick them off, it's ending this inequality. It's making people pay their fair share in taxes the richest. It's finding a way out of the student debt slavery. It's finding ways to keep people in their homes and stop the evictions. And it's making sure that those who got us into this economic mess, the banksters, the Wall Street, be held accountable in some ways.
So,
and getting money out of our politics.
So one place you want to occupy for sure is the White House, because Goldman Sachs, you've got these self-dealing guys continuing to run economic policy, and, you know, it's Goldman Sachs. I'm sorry. They're all Goldman Sachs alums. You know, they go back to Goldman Sachs. They go back into government. And so, really, that's a White House issue.
Well, let me begin with Occupy, the most successful Occupy White House, the White House in the last few months. And this comes back to the media in a way, and I'll come back to Goldman Sachs if I must. But was, you know, remember in August when there were about 1,200 people doing civil disobedience around the White House protesting the Keystone Pipeline? Now, the media, corporate mainstream media, was like this on that. Imagine, by the way, if 1,200 Tea Partiers had hitched themselves to the gate of the White House. I say that because it seems to me that when Occupy in September launched, moved, took the park in New York, and then moved out across the country, suddenly there was more attention being paid to other movements, like the environmental civil disobedience movement, And it exposed how the media has done such a great disservice to this country in the last few years by saying that there was one movement in this country, the Tea Party. There are many other movements, and the Occupy Wall Street, in its many moving parts, the 99% movement, has now brought into sharper relief and forced the media to pay attention not only to issues, but to other movements. I could tick off 10 or 15, but they've been toiling in the field around this country or inside the Beltway in different ways for years, and now there's a space. I'm not saying we're going to see, you know, movement into a new universe tomorrow, but there's a space now for new ideas and for people who are more receptive, it seems to me, not just in this room, and great to be in this room, but there's more receptivity to issues that were just kind of closed off.
Well,
and the media played a role in that.
Yeah, the media is not playing, you know, that helpful a role, generally speaking. I mean, you know, we defended the proposition of mainstream media in New York
yeah.
a couple of years ago. But the reality is that there's a attention span that's quite short.
And that will be a problem. And there's an interest in conflict.
Now, well, there's an interest in drama, conflict being obviously part of drama, a piece of drama. But there's also, I mean, you know, the Nation is not un-mainstream media, which is a point made that night. I mean, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, but longevity isn't necessarily mainstreamness. But there is a
but
sense...
But you say it's minority ideas... are pushed in the Nation, right? Minority ideas get a hearing in the Nation. But at a time of such disintermediation,
right.
and, you know, everybody has a blog, is there such a thing as a minority idea?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the minority idea comes from the fact that, as you were talking about earlier, there are issues that don't get the attention they deserve. I mean, one example. I mean, part of what the Nation tries to do is drive issues into a national conversation that are off the radar. We did a special issue 3 years ago, 4 years ago, called The New Inequality. I would like to republish it tomorrow. I mean, it could be republished, and it would have a hearing, and it would be received in a very different way because of the political climate. But I do think, I was talking to someone earlier today, I think, again, like the New York Times had a cover story on Sunday about Ronald Lauder's aggressive tax management strategy. Tough piece. And I can tell you, sitting in New York, taking on a kind of fixture in the political, economic, social scene of New York, and I think it was part of what Occupy and the movement and the climate has done, moving papers like the New York Times to cover issues like that. But, you know, how many, you know, that's important. And I do think critical mindedness is part of what the Nation also is about.
Well, let me sidetrack a little bit. You've talked about WikiLeaks, and you've said
yes.
some positive things about it, and have talked about, you know, WikiLeaks creating the atmosphere for change because of the transparency that they provide. What single thing do you think has come out of that huge release over time of WikiLeaks document that's really been a fundamental change of policy or people's lives?
I mean, I think it probably played some role in what we're seeing in the Arab uprisings. I mean, I think it's played a role and we're doing a project drilling down beyond the headlines, but it's played a role in moving people to see some of the backroom dealings of U.S. foreign policy, and it's exposed people to think harder, and I do think it played a role in leading people in Tunisia or Egypt to look at some of those cables and see what people already knew in their gut but now saw more revealed in WikiLeaks about the alliances between a U.S. foreign policy with the most repressive elements in those countries. And let us hope that that changes as the Arab uprisings
yeah,
continue.
Yeah, I have to say...
But I think any attempt, any time you can learn more about what is being done in our name, the people's name, is critical. That's part of what transparency is about, and part of what, you know this, I mean, Freedom of Information Act is not working well. It's still not working well under the Obama administration.
It's working
and there's
less well under the
less
Obama
well.
Administration.
And there is excessive, and some of that, I would argue, is post-9/11. Post-9/11, if you're at an endless war on terror, is going to lead to a decline in information, transparency, access. But I think any time you can have less secrecy, too much is hyper-classified in this country. There is too much secrecy that is not needed. And that's where WikiLeaks as a phenomenon has become important, putting aside the characters involved and how it was handled. And by the way, it was handled quite deftly at the outset, partnering with papers like The Guardian, partnering with traditional newspapers of distinction. And I don't know if people know this, but it was part WikiLeaks released documents around the world to papers in India, papers in Haiti, papers in the Middle East, in Latin America. So it's had an impact in countries that we don't yet know enough about. And at The Nation, we're doing a project with six editors in Latin America to look at how WikiLeaks has played a role in their politics.
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened is the media got distracted by the personality issues and Julian Assange and all of, I mean, it's a fascinating, dark, twisted story, whatever's true.
But people got obsessed with that.
People got obsessed with it, and that's what happens. I mean, perhaps doesn't happen and probably doesn't happen to The Nation, but with...
Well, we have a cover story next week on the Kim Kardashian wedding, no.
You got to pay the bills.
No, I mean, more, you know, but...
The serious side of Kim Kardashian.
That's right, yeah, the underside, the dark side of the marriage. No, I do think it is a problem. I mean, listen, I do think, and we are, more seriously, we are undertaking a project next year, a kind of Work Projects Administration, inspired by the Work Projects Administration of the New Deal period, the Writers Project Administration, to have a team cross this country, writers, artists, documentarians, photographers, to document poverty in this country. And it's the 40th anniversary of Michael Harrington's book, The Other America. And I think we have the resources, human resources, people who want to do this project and who could do it in a way that tells the human story, because I think human stories are key. I'm not, you know, and also using human stories to kind of tell us the story about the structural problems of poverty in this country, so that it has more than just a human interest quality, but it could lead to change. And if we were working in a system that worked, it might lead to hearings. It might lead, but I think politically it has resonance, Phil, because millions of people are now squeezed in the middle class, are, again, feeling a check or two away from near poverty. And so there's a little more openness, again, to think hard about what's happened in a country which is, by the way, the richest country in the world. And what I hate, again, and this is where The Nation tries to reset the narrative, the idea that America is broke. It's not broke. It's not broke. Our priorities are broken. And there's a misplaced obsession, and this is my obsession, it drives me crazy, but a misplaced obsession with debt and deficits as the national emergency of our time. And I think that has driven the storyline inside the Beltway. We did a cover story a couple weeks ago called How the Austerity Class Rules Washington. And it's a portrait of think tanks, of philanthropists, of neoliberals, not just conservatives and right-wingers, but who have framed it in a way so that it's very hard to tell an alternative story. That, too, I think, has shifted a little because of new voices, new forces emerging from the 99%, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, all I know is you better have Twitter and Facebook involved in this project, otherwise...
We do, absolutely, and we have... all kinds of new media and Tumblr, and because I agree, you need to use all of that. And I think that's been a very powerful force, and we use all of that at The Nation. However, I do think that with all of the new media, one thing, and we had a correspondent write about this in a quite poetic way, at Occupy Wall Street in New York, a few miles from our office, one thing that struck our correspondent was how many young people came to the square and how they were just kind of caught up in conversation, talking to people, general assemblies, conversations, because so many people,
scary,
so many people have lived in front of their laptop or been part of, you know, the new media, that the ability to communicate and talk and sit around Now, you can't do that all the time. People, you want people to have jobs, and they're doing this and that. But that's been lost, too, because I think you need that online organizing, but you need offline, too. And so that's why I hope the sense of moving, maybe not in encampments, which become difficult to maintain, but you find ways to work together in occupying different spaces.
Do you think the technology has actually changed things more fundamentally than individuals, than people, than movements, let's say, in the last 10 years? Because technology has changed everything about the way we live.
But fused, I think, and I work with a really smart guy named Mika Sifri, but he is brilliant in talking about the fusion of technology and movements. I mean, look at Wisconsin or look at Tahrir Square. You need the people who are going to come to the square, but they come partly, and I know this out of Madison because of our correspondent, where you might have had 5,000 people, you had 50,000 people. So there's a power to it. But it's a good question. But I think without the people power, technology, new media, is a more sterile force and not as powerful.
You mentioned people power, so I will take that as a cue, because I covered the Marcos Aquino.
Oh, yeah.
And the fall of Marcos and the rise of Aquino in the Philippines. And what I learned is that there's a black and white approach that particularly the media, but generally consumers of media like to take. So in the Philippines, you had a vicious, brutal, murderous dictator, and you had a pious, sincere, well-meaning, inspirational political widow. Well, that wasn't true at all. She didn't care about poor people, never once. Probably had never met one, even though 70% and more of that population lives under the poverty line. And he had actually done some things for the country that were useful and helpful while he pocketed a little piece of the action every time. And then I went to El Salvador, where, you know, Oliver Stone and others romanticized the guerrilla movement. But, you know, the FMLN was out there killing mayors in cold blood. And, you know, it was a wildly sexist movement. You know, you'd go to these guerrilla camps up in the mountains, and the women would, in commandante clothing, fatigues, would still be serving you the coffee and grumbling under their breath that the guys were running the show. There's a black and white problem that we have, and I don't mean race. What I mean is the way we look at things. So there's a polarization that's going on. You know, you have the Tea Party over here, you have Occupy over here. And so while you talk about we have to strengthen over here, we have to gird against these guys, it seems to me that there's a, you know, because life is more complicated than that as our
people. I agree.
People.
I agree. And I think a theme that runs through my book is, you know, many questions, not all answers. I mean, I don't think in black and white Manichaean terms. But I do think here's real kind of power structure analysis. I think you need countervailing forces. I think in this country at the moment, we've had such one-sided power. To be simplistic, perhaps, but corporate power. You go back 30, 40, 50 years, and not to be too nostalgic about this moment in the country then, but you had labor, you had business, you had a government that was functioning, and you had more of a balance. And that's where I feel it's out of whack. I really feel that 1% may be too simplistic. In fact, I think it should be the 100% movement, because there are a lot of 1%ers, by the way, who should not be vilified. This is where I agree with you.
Well, I would assume that you are a 1%er.
But you can be a 1%er who is with the 99%. The 1%ers I think you shout out and call out and hold accountable are those who say, you know, I'm not good. I think we should cut corporate taxes, and we should cut taxes for the richest, and we shouldn't have any fair share, and screw it. I'm going to live in my privatized environment. I don't care about the commons or the civic situation in this country. That's, in my view, truly damaging to the possibility of already beleaguered ideals. But I agree with you. Nothing is simple. I mean, I've covered the former Soviet Union and Russia. I mean, I could go on at great length about how Boris Yeltsin, you know, in many ways undermined democracy and became this hero of democracy in this country. Or Lech Walesa, interesting figure, but in many ways wasn't the pure working bloke many made him out to be.
But and Gorbachev is someone who you do have.
Gorbachev also, I have huge amount of respect. I think he was a visionary and an unusual figure who came to power and saw that he needed to change his country, and he used his powers to do that. He withdrew from Afghanistan in 3 or 4 years. He called for nuclear abolition. He worked with Ronald Reagan. And most important, he understood that you needed political solutions, not military solutions. And when the Soviet troops were ready to come out of the barracks so that the Berlin Wall would not come down, he stay in the barracks. The empire is going. We cannot be a country that is going to be one of glasnost and perestroika if we live in the way we have.
So, well, this is the complexity because...
But then what he did, and you know, when you were... when he, and it's the 20th anniversary of the Soviet Union, of the end of the Soviet Union, many people in Russia blame him for the economic conditions in which they live. They blame him for the end of a country for which many felt it was more of a cradle to grave welfare state rather than a totalitarian system. Anyway, I have great respect for him, but you can also see people's weaknesses. And you talk about Salvador. Put aside the FMLN, but what about those people, the priests and the nuns? To me, that's the people power in that situation. The FMLN was a revolutionary force seeking power. But and the people movements were those trying to alleviate the poverty, trying to find a balance in a country.
No question, the liberation theology had a much stronger effect on the underlying society than FMLN offensives in San Salvador. But I've got a sign. I've got to read this. Hang on one second. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Katrina is discussing her latest book, The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Okay. Sorry.
No.
I want to get to a couple of these questions. I do note, I watched a video last night that was great, you and Colbert.
Oh, God.
And he asked you to apologize for Obama. And he said, repudiate him 3 times before the cock crows. Anyway, that's not a question.
Was that election night 2010?
It was.
Oh.
He was.
He said at the end, I filibustered him.
You did. You went after him. But he went after you, too. Did he do the thing backstage where he comes in and he says...
And he throws you because he's such a good...
Nice guy.
He's like, did you remember one of the bright lights in the Bush era was when he spoke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner? That was one of the great moments because you rarely see someone in your face. You know, there was the president in your face, and it was at that moment when the country was... What is going on? But it was really a rebuke to journalists. You remember?
Yes, I do. And I went on his show as a journalist, and I was sweating. And he comes into your dressing room beforehand, and he explains to you that from then on he's going to be in character.
Yeah.
And he's going to
becomes Bill O'Reilly.
And I am a person who doesn't. There's a phrase that I was trying to remember last night in anticipation of this conversation. I'm a person who has willful disregard for everything you believe in. So anyway.
You have to kind of do a mindset check, because it's very confusing.
So from the audience, last year an Obama-appointed Blue Ribbon Elder Statesman's Commission produced a package of recommendations to address the nation's financial crisis, yet this appeared to be dead on arrival. Why? What's your perspective on that?
Is that the Bowles Simpson?
I'm assuming, whoever wrote this.
He did not support it because I do think there was pushback in the right way because that commission was very much focused on cuts and not investment. I mean, the great deficit in this country is the investment deficit, investment in people, investment in our infrastructure. But there are attempts to revive it, but it was a kind of super committee proposal. And I think it's a good thing the super committee failed to reach an agreement. We'll see where that goes, but it was not a fair deal. There was so little revenue and it was so much cutting. And I think how we get back on track in a moment, by the way, where someone was writing the other day that the anti-tax mania is at an all-time low. I mean, when you begin to think that Reagan was willing to raise taxes, then you have to I realize how extreme. And by the way, someone said the other day, Grover Norquist may be the most powerful person in America at this point, because that pledge he has held these candidates to is a star of the beast. I mean, you know that expression. It's basically take the government and strangle it in the bathtub and starve it of its possibility. Obviously, the government has a lot of problems. I'm agreeing with your libertarian impulse. But it also is keeping millions from sinking deeper into poverty. It has a role to play in a country that, you know, has not the land grant colleges, the highways, the bridges, all of this. I understand there's a bridge out here that is about to be built.
It's not being built. Well.
Yeah. Well, the infrastructure. I'm all for infrastructure.
Yeah. But Obama, in a way, has to be the luckiest politician on earth, because if you look at the Republican lineup, it's like one big giant Michael Dukakis in an oversized tank hat. You know, I mean,
we're talking about this earlier. I mean, you know, the idea that Newt Gingrich is now at the top of the heap.
You don't want to be at the top of that heap, because every time someone gets to the top of the heap,
they expose.
They get shot out.
But more seriously, I mean, it seems like anybody but Romney, right? That's what's going on at the moment.
I think Herman Cain is a breath of fresh air. Really.
I'm not going to sit here and reassess Herman Cain with you as he reassesses his candidacy.
I thought that Rick Perry was a guy who was going to provide us with entertainment, but Herman Cain, fabulous.
Newt Gingrich, you know, but I'm going to get serious on you, not that I haven't in these last minutes, but Newt Gingrich, okay, so here's a guy who's really an uber lobbyist, right? And by the way, in saying he was stepping down the other day, Barney Frank talked about Michelle Bachmann and et cetera, but what struck me was he also called out Newt and said he held Newt Gingrich, because I always think of a reptile, Newt. Newt Gingrich responsible.
I get nervous around reptiles myself.
For the demonization of opponents that has contributed to the atmosphere we live in today. And I do think he came into the House, he slashed all the caucuses, the civility, caucus, and so we're seeing that. But also, this is a man who, a few days ago, I'm sure you followed this, talked about education reform in the context of firing the janitors in schools and putting the kids to work. Now, a lot of the media call that unconventional. I mean,
work play.
Yeah, work play. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, let's repeal child labor laws, which we fought hard for in this country.
Or, let's repeal childhood. How about that?
Or bring in Dickens to chronicle the era of. But it's just, but I do think there's a cruelty amidst the reality show debates we've been subjected to, where someone said the other day, which division is running this, entertainment or news, right, as they do? There's a cruelty. I mean, you know, when people cheer for more executions or cheer that someone dies without health care or boo a gay soldier who's been fighting in Iraq, it's kind of, you know, what's going on?
But apropos WikiLeaks, you know, I'd rather know. I mean,
You'd rather know, yeah.
I'm joking about Herman Cain, obviously, but there's a guy who can't hide the truth very well. And, you know, that makes me more comfortable, not with him, but with the idea that I know what he's about, so I can make a decision.
But are you talking about the women coming forward, or the fact that he, when asked about Afghanistan, he said he didn't quite know what he would do?
Both.
But when he became president,
both.
He would check it out.
But I mean, we've had presidents who've been reelected who have that. I'm talking about you. We talk about transparency in WikiLeaks and the value of transparency to our culture and our society. And frankly, I mean, Chris Matthews was here recently peddling his latest JFK book, which you know is a hagiography of JFK, as far as I'm concerned, because he's a huge fan. And you know, I was going to ask you, JFK, you know, was he vastly underestimated? Was he a sort of mythologized, weak president? I mean, that's the debate going on. But talk about controlling the message. And the Obama administration, we talked about their view towards the press, they are more controlling of the message than the Bush administration. And in the courts.
Well, they haven't done a very good job.
No, they haven't done a good job. Which is,
I mean,
they're doing
you're
a bad
gonna do
thing
control.
Badly. I don't know if that's good or bad.
I mean, that's another, you know, they used, that was a campaign that was quite brilliant in its use of new media.
It was.
And that, again, is striking because every president uses the medium of his, someday her own time, right? You got the radio, you had TV with Kennedy. But we haven't seen this White House effectively harness any of the media, you know, any of the media. And to me, that is mystifying.
Goldman Sachs.
All right, come back to Goldman Sachs. Listen, I think one of the grave, bringing in Larry, one of the reasons I supported President Obama was I didn't want to see Larry Summers in the White House. Because, no, really, there was a sense, and it's unfair, with Hillary Clinton, until the end of her campaign, there wasn't a sense of how she could bring her history to bear. It was very much a restorationist campaign. You felt you were going to get back the Clinton administration, part three. And so you really didn't want to see the Rubin team, Robert Rubin and Summers. And I think, okay, if you feel that it was such a crisis, a panic at that time, as many say that this administration felt it was, coming out of the calamitous misrule of the Bush administration, don't forget that was into the TARP, bring in, as President Obama promised, a team of rivals. Remember he talked about Doris Kearns Goodwin's book and the Lincoln cabinet? But all you had was really Summers and then Geithner. And both of them had their paw prints over either the policies that had led to the crisis or, in Geithner's case in New York, working with the Fed. That, in my mind, opened the door to the Tea Party. In some ways. I mean, it opened the door to a right-wing populism because people saw in this White House favoritism toward Goldman Sachs, toward the banks. And the problem was the Democratic progressive left populism hasn't emerged until now because I think for too long, many felt with Obama in the White House, things would be sorted out. But that's where you see, I feel, movements become important. And every administration in modern times has had to deal with insurgencies or movements on its left and on its right. Reagan, in many ways, was a movement president. And I say that with, except for his work with Gorbachev, all contempt for what he did in damage to this country. But I do think you need to now see that the pendulum has swung and that I may have mentioned this, but the Pew report today that the Tea Party in many ways has lost a lot of its mojo because of overreach, and it's out of sync with the values of so many people. And we could have seen that at those crazy Tea Party meetings in the summer of 2009 when one of the Tea Party people stands up and says, "Government, take your hands off my Medicare."
But that was what was fascinating about
it. You see how internalized, those programs.
Who doesn't want to watch a car wreck? I mean, that's part of the issue.
It's done a lot of damage.
I want you to know that I'm going to tweet, that, quoting Katrina VandenHeuvel, that the Obama administration is responsible for the Tea Party. I'm going to do that.
It opened a vacuum. And I write in the book that summer, that hot summer of 2009, in August, and when Barney Frank, by the way, was one of the few who really shouted back and said, but the president could have mobilized, and there were people out there mobilizing on their own, but a pragmatic progressive president, which in many ways people think pragmatic progressive, would have understood the power of having people in those squares, in those places, to combat a message that was full of mendacity and misinformation. It wasn't just... You remember the death panels? Part of that, of course, is incumbent upon us as citizens and in the media to fight back and expose that mendacity. But also a White House went pretty quiet that August. And only after Labor Day did the president come forward and begin to speak again to the people and explain where they were moving with a compromised health program.
Even Nixon went to the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Monument to meet with... Yeah. With anti-war demonstrators.
Counterfactual history is dangerous, but I sometimes think that, and I write in the book about this a little, if Senator Kennedy had been alive, I think he was so critical, I think, to President Obama's election, his endorsement in that pivotal period when, you had a lot of turbulence and turmoil. It was early on after South Carolina. But I think he would have been an important inside the system push toward something bigger and would have pushed to have more connection to outside the Beltway. Obama's now traveling around the country. He's forced to because of the election. But if you sit in the Beltway too long and get into those backroom deals, it gets...
Well, even movements can be cloistered. I mean,
absolutely.
I remember a dinner in Southern California a few years ago during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, and it was this guy from Annenberg had hosted this dinner. It was Mickey Kantor from the Clinton
right.
administration. It was Norman Lear and his wife. It was Larry David and Laurie. Is it Laurie David? Bob Scheer and Marta Zucchino. And they were sitting around weeping in their soup, expensive soup, about the fact that we were living in hell, that Rupert Murdoch owned the news, that George W. Bush was president.
Yeah.
And I couldn't restrain myself. Here's Norman Lear, who had his finger on the pulse of American culture successfully for 30 years. Why can't you figure out a way to deliver a message that is not just important, but it's also captivating?
That's very important. And I do think how we can find messages that speak to people where they are, but are also like, Jon Stewart, or that have some satire.
Right.
Like
well,
John a Colbert.
Stewart arose out of that.
Sorry. Right. The sense of both exposing with satire. And, that's why, and also it's far more educational and opens people's eyes
right.
to the hypocrisy and the corruption of our politics. The problem sometimes with, and I love them, Stewart and Colbert, and I think sometimes the problem with our media, you want the captivating stories and ideas and images and words and vocabulary, but a lot of the Colbert, Jon Stewart stuff, it's just like so absurd, so corrupt, so over the top, that people, I'm out of here. I don't want to be involved. I'm not going to get engaged. It's like, why bother?
Well, that's where a large number of people get their news. So.
Well, but I think the Obama campaign was a pivotal point, bringing people in. Then they leave. And now there's a possibility that people come back in. I agree with you that movements also have their problems. But I think it's a moment again of people waking up to the possibility of engagement. Not in, in different ways, where they are in communities, and finding ways to, and I think it's important not to weep in your soup. And I also think it's important, by the way, I write in the book, I'm not really into the kind of betrayal sweepstakes, like President Obama betrayed me, sorry, my mic. That doesn't get you very far. I think as a journalist, as an editor, you want to do the reporting, the investigations, to call out abuses, to expose, but also to propose and put ideas out there. But to, just do the denunciation is going to lead to the disempowerment and despair that our adversaries seek.
Leads into screen addiction. So you didn't answer the 1% question.
Oh,
where you fit in that? So let me ask you this: what tax rate would you be willing to be taxed if people in, at that level in our society are all taxed at that rate?
I would go back to the Eisenhower marginal, what Eisenhower was taxing people at? 70 to 90%. I'm not kidding. I think that you'd want to go back to a rate where there is a super tax on the very rich, and a super tax on millionaires. And then you definitely want, this is so wonky, forgive me, but you want to get rid of these, look at the loophole for private equity and hedge funders where they're paying 15%. Look at the capital gains tax, which is 15%. So we are taxing work, but barely taxing wealth. And that is just the wrong priority. And then I would put into play something called the Robin Hood tax, which is really wonky, but it is an idea whose time has come. And radicals like the French President Sarkozy and radicals like Angela Merkel of Germany are for this. It's a 0.5% levy on any stock, private equity, hedge fund, currency transaction that would bring about $350 billion a year. And you got some of my heroes are the nurses of this country, the National Nurses United, who, you know, heal America, tax Wall Street. So I think there are a whole slew of things that good one percenters are for. And Warren Buffett, complicated, but he, you know, has said something wise. He's complicated. I know. Yeah. There's a lot of games playing going on. But
if you dissect what he says, he's not really offering up a whole lot.
But he is talking about, why should I be taxed less than my assistant, my secretary? And he's also called, I think, you know, there's a group, I don't quite like the name, but Patriotic Millionaires. But it's a belief that you owe back to a country that has helped make you what you are. Steve Jobs, our media columnist Eric Alterman, had a very tough column last issue. It was tough, but it was tough in the sense, not about the fact that Apple and its practices in China, labor practices, but here you had a man of great wealth, who, you know, was talking about cutting taxes and then never really gave of his philanthropic wealth. And poor Bill Gates.
Yeah.
He gets nailed for being so square. And you can disagree with some of his, but he's, you know, he's out there.
He is out there. I mean, I think he came a little, all those guys who are out there now came a little late to that party, but, you know, they got very rich very young. I wanted to leave a little bit of time for our audience questions. I have to say that I apologize. One of the reasons I haven't read more questions from the audience is because they're all so damn good. Usually it's the guy with the aluminum hat on who's getting CIA messages. Not really, but this audience. So my apologies. If you want to line up, we have a few more minutes at the mics here. We'll take a few questions. And please make sure you make them questions. Yes, sir.
My question is, I've been interested in AmeriCorps and other related programs, and from what I can tell in your book and the nation, you don't support that or don't talk about it very much, and the Tea Party is advocating eliminating the Corporation for National and Community Service along with AmeriCorps, where President Obama campaigned to expand it to 250,000, and Senator Kennedy in the first few months of the Obama administration helped pass that expansion. So I was wondering, what role can the nation play in helping to support this program?
I think programs like that are critical. I mean, we've done a lot of work around expanding the programs bringing, for example, doctors into rural community centers, and AmeriCorps is a good program. I think all of those should be supported. It's true we haven't done as much. There has been controversy at the magazine. I'm more of a supporter of Teach for America, for example, than some of my colleagues. It's a good program.
Yes, sir.
What, in your opinion, could we do collectively for the next step for Occupy Wall Street?
What is your main interest in the issues, the set of issues that has been raised by Occupy Wall Street? Bless you. If it's money and politics, you should join with those who are occupying the Supreme Court, fighting in localities and states for clean money reform, and fighting for an amendment strategy to overturn the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, and fighting in elections to change a Supreme Court that may have too long a grip on this country's future.
What would you think of having a National General Assembly modeled on the original Continental Congress in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, beginning on July 4th of 2012, coming up with a list of grievances that this assembly debated?
You know, Lawrence Lessig, someone I admire who has written for The Nation, has right. talked about a new constitutional convention.
Right.
I think it's early. I think it's tricky. I don't mean to sound too reformist and conservative. But when you say make up a list of grievances, I think we could sit in this room tonight, which we're not going to, and we would come up with a list of six, if not demands, more than grievances, of ideas that need to be made real and lead to change. So I think you need to find your issue, work in your community, and work both in the organizing around that issue. Link up with groups doing work. If it's student debt, find ways both to take on the banks, to take on local legislators, and to take on Congress in the short term. It's not very revolutionary, but I think I said radically at this event we did on 9/11, I said I thought this country was in a pre-revolutionary moment. In some ways, it was about a week before Occupy Wall Street launched, but I believe in evolution, not revolution.
Yes, sir.
Katrina, did you read George Packer's Foreign Affairs article that backs up the Occupy movement, and that's Foreign Affairs? Jeffrey Sachs' New York Times article about the new progressive movement. It seems this is a bogus lament coming out more and more about, well, what's the Occupy agenda? What do they want? What's their program? There should be a program, but folks like you articulated here tonight pretty well some agenda. Sachs had talked about re-regulating the financial markets, public investment up, money out of politics, ultra-rich elites progressively taxed. It's all there. Why isn't it being more articulated by the media?
But it is, I think. I mean, I think it is. It's not up to Occupy. I mean, different Occupies, by the way, do have demands. I mean, there are two or three Occupies which have demanded that Congress introduce a piece of legislation to amend the Supreme Court decision. But it seems to me it's up to people like the nation. It's up to the nation. It's up to other groups like Rebuild the Dream or National People's Action or people like in the Progressive Caucus. Occupy Wall Street in many ways is a spirit. It's a spirit. And they are committed at the moment not to have concrete demands. But Jeffrey Sachs has laid out a set, and we have six ideas. One would be the Robin Hood tax. The other would be to change the way our tax structure is organized. How to get money out of politics, hold corporations responsible, support attorneys general who are fighting for fair foreclosure relief. There's six or ten.
Have you ever been wrong?
I don't think Occupy Wall Street is a kind of moral, it's a moral compass. It's not going to be what you seek. Jeffrey Sachs is articulating what he thinks it should do. George Packer, and by the way, the fact that Foreign Affairs makes that lead essay is again a shift in our times. I'm wrong all the time. I'm wrong all the time.
Let's have one example.
Well, I said on national television the night of November election night 2000, as Florida was coming in, that this election would be decided that night. People may remember that election, which ended in the selection of the presidency by the Supreme Court, corroding many people's faith in our democracy, went on for 2 months, 3 months, and ended up being decided by the governor's, the Bush's brother, a Supreme Court elected, chosen by his father. And
there's a lot better answer than George Bush answered that same question. Well, I am...
he was asked, what did he say?
Has he ever been wrong? He said, I can't think of a time. Right? And he's still saying that right there in Texas.
Humble man.
Humble man. We're about out of time, and I'm going to... Do you have a very short question?
Hi. The short question is, what's the circulation of the nation now?
Circulation is 160,000 print and 1.5 million readers at thenation.com.
Didn't Paul Newman and some other folks?
Yeah, Paul Newman was a great loyal friend and supporter of the Nation, and his sort of partner in crime, Robert Redford, has been a supporter. But we have a circle of 100 people who give each year, and more interesting, 30,000 Nation associates who give a little each month above the subscription price in the belief that the nation's not just a media institution, but a community, and 40 discussion groups around this country.
So do these people... These people obviously support the nation for what it espouses and believes in, but I'm just wondering if they all know that as part of your cultural religion that you have dirty martinis and Marvin Gaye, whether you've exposed
it's
that.
It's exposed at all. In this introduction. You got to keep perspective, and you know, everyone's work in this room, I'm sure, is demanding, but it is it's trying to make sense of these times and trying to keep some hope. You know, if we were meeting this time last year, it was a pretty bleak period. I'm not saying it's not that bleak now, but you were coming off an election where the Tea Party claimed it had a mandate, and it all seemed like the long view was necessary. So I try to read history, then drink some dirty martinis.
Yeah, and watch listen to Marvin Gaye and True Blood, yeah.
Yeah.
And thank you
somewhere
for not calling this the game change.
I love the Dylan Radican. The Dylan Radican, I mean, how many? God, he got vampires in there. He got everything.
Listen, this has been fabulous. Our thanks to Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation and author of The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This has been fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We want to remind everybody that copies of Katrina's book on sale in the lobby. She'll be pleased to sign them. We appreciate your allowing her to make her way to the lobby as quickly as possible so she can sign them. I'm Phil Bronstein. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.